how was it that we were introduced to each other? Did you send me an email sometime in the late 90s?
I believe it was through Wilson, actually. There was...
Who is Wilson now?
Wilson Leary. That was Timothy Leary's nephew. There's pictures of him with him, and he looks a lot like him. So I thought for a while that he was just bullshitting, but no.
Wilson Leary gave you my name.
Something like that, yes. There was a couple people I met. Some of them were kind of groupie types that, you know, latch on to anything Leary. And I'm not quite sure of it. It's either through Wilson. I'm pretty sure it's through Wilson. But I was also in the early 2000s. Well, no, that comes way later. Going back to the late 90s.
Yeah, let me give you my recollection is that I was at work one day and I received an email from you related to ketamine. And I don't know if you had associated me with ketamine or you were writing to ask me a question about ketamine. But somewhere in our email exchange, I dashed off a poem to you.
Yes.
About Special K.
Yes.
Right. Was that our first?
I have that listed on my side somewhere.
Yeah. So yeah, we're talking with Machine Elf, the moderator, owner of Transam.org. It's a blog of, what do you call it? Visionary weirdness, I would say, maybe.
Well, I coined the words. Sort of coined. It's they're used elsewhere, but. In pornography, sci-fi, and visionary art, with a psychedelic underpinning. But it's basically technology and psychedelia and general interest as well. It's not very niche. It's pretty broad because the whole sci world has gotten a lot bigger now with microdosing, and it's kind of hip to do. And I've always melded the two together, technology and psychedelics with rationality.
Yeah, I think that was a very 90s thing for people to do, to be like the techno shaman, because there was the internet evolving at the same time that all these new research chemicals were coming into the popular consciousness. So I feel like a lot of people from our generation in the 90s there, we very much view technology and psychedelics as somehow hand in hand.
It might be a Gen X thing, but I just remember raves and Are You Serious? Terrence McKenna was in his heyday then. It was a really exciting time. And some people accuse me of living in the past. Dude, you just live in the 90s. I'm going, dude, I wish I could live in the 90s. It's not even possible now.
So let's go back to that time. I mean, I'm guessing it must have been 95 or 96. I was publishing Trip Magazine at the time.
Yes, and with those articles about doing ketamine and metaprogramming and as a meditational aid. I remember you've kind of disavowed that, but I just remember just glomming onto that.
Yeah, there was.
I was so into ketamine in the 90s.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. I was very much into, I was into ketamine in the 90s. I had sort of moved out of my LSD phase at this point and was very interested in ketamine. Because there weren't a lot of people doing it, or at least writing about it. And I thought that it was maybe one of the more fascinating substances I'd ever done. And I was wondering why there weren't more people doing it. And you were maybe one of the only people I knew at the time that was a super huge K-head. And even now, when I talk about K-heads that I knew back in the day, you're maybe the first person that comes to my mind.
Oh, I definitely was. You know, I even went into studies at NYU because of my brain. Had done so much ketamine. But at that time, it was you. It was Carl Jansen. I don't think his book had come out yet. And then, of course, the late D.M. Turner had some really good trip reports, I remember, on Arrowhead. And that was it. And I took the whole 90s like mindset and just took it to its logical end, which ended up with LSD and ketamine.
Yeah. Yeah, and those were definitely my two, the two major substances that I work with, although I did spend a lot of time using psilocybin mushrooms.
West Coast. I was in New York, so.
Yeah, to various levels of success, I would have to say. Psilocybin mushrooms were a little too unpredictable. I found out in the end. But yeah, ketamine was extremely predictable. LSD was also extremely predictable, as long as you have nice measured doses. So they were a lot easier to work with, at least in an experimental setting.
They're more lawful and rather than chaotic in that sense.
I'm more lawful than chaotic. I'm lawful neutral, not chaotic neutral, maybe. Can you describe what your ketamine use was like back in those days? Because at the height of my ketamine use, I was using maybe once a day in the evening, and I was shooting intramuscularly maybe four times a week. And
you were able to turn reality on and off at will, like in certain frequencies, like 10 hertz per second.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's extreme control. And I think that for me, my brain just went with it. And I would just travel around and I would be assaulted by chaos. And I had probably my most intense trip was shooting up K and on acid at Twilo, which was the big club back then.
Right, of course.
I
remember Twilo.
And I actually walked around and everything was completely normal, except nobody had eyeballs. And I would look really close and you could see like glowing obsidian in their eye sockets. And I could see a faint, like, sucking in of light, like, faint on the very edges, but everything else was completely normal. And then and then it really kicked in. and all of a sudden I was in this astral haze, and all of a sudden all the eyes came back. But it was just one eye in the very center of my vision. And that went on for about 3 minutes. And there was about 1,000 people there. That was the craziest experience I'd ever had. I would like to travel with it and have interesting experiences with it. I really wasn't. I've never been a meditator.
You mean travel in physical space, like go places, or astral travel?
Like the whole astral travel thing,
right?
But also one thing that was really starting once I started doing a lot, I started to get what you would call psychosis, where I felt that, you know, the whole John Lilly thing, that you, by cutting off of your senses and just being conscious, you're able to go into the science fiction, like, frequency of the universe, and you have this felt presence of all these other galactical intelligences. And I thought it was a breakthrough. I thought that eventually ketamine was going to be a huge technological boost. And looking back, I was probably just really fucked up at the time. But it does make sense on paper.
I have to say, I also had those feelings that I was surprised that more people weren't using ketamine as a technical training tool for figuring out how consciousness worked. Or how systems in the body worked, because I found that when you could, and what you're talking about, like the lawful neutral versus chaotic neutral piece of this, is that I would find specific dose ranges of ketamine where it was a lot easier for me to have self-control over how my mind was switching on and off, which was around 55 to 60 milligrams intramuscularly. But then when you got up to 70 or 75, the flipping on and off was less in your control, and you became caught in this toggle state between waking and sleeping, which is, I think, maybe the most dangerous state, because you feel like you can get up and move around, but when you start to get up and move around, you're staggering and running into things, and you can't keep yourself balanced, and everything feels weird because your sense of gravity is messed up. And then there is maybe the 75 to 90 milligram intramuscular, where I would get a full lights out experience where I was prone and out the whole time, but my mind was traveling through, you know, various tunnels and mazes and through conspiracy theories and connecting all things together. And I could, like, move through all of the channels in my body, blood vessels and nerves and whatever, and do sort of this deep dive of reconstructing everything from the inside out. And I thought, more people need to know how to do this.
Right, because you feel like you're a monkey and you're sitting in front of a computer, and it's preordained that it's been made, and there's a whole environment in there what Terence McKenna called vacant skyscrapers. And that was his big beef against ketamine. But going into what you were saying, and it reminded me of an article you wrote in TRP in the 90s where your intent really does, you know, not just set and setting, but you basically said, if you just want to party, you're going to have just a party. But if you really want to like meditate, and if you're going in with intent and self-awareness and discovery, then you're going to go to a much higher level, deeper level than just somebody who's doing it recreationally. So your approach definitely mirrored what you wrote in that article.
Well, yeah. And I feel like I was doing a lot of, quote, meta-programming exercises where I was trying to control or modify certain behaviors of mine that I wanted to tweak. And somehow this meta-programming required me doing ketamine at least 3 or 4 times a week. And I'm not sure that any of it ever worked. But I did have, like, a clinical approach to it where many, many times that I actually went into the ketamine state, I did have an intent, or I did have a programming experiment, or I did have something that I was trying to do. But ultimately, I don't know if I was successful at any of those things. I mean, I feel like maybe that I was just setting up a mythos for my use that allowed me to keep doing it without really questioning or checking my behavior.
Right. It's almost like a Ponzi scheme. It turns into this self-perpetuating cycle where in order to go to the next step, it's like a video game where they try to preach addiction. And of course it is psychological addiction. I mean, I think it affects smarter people and more creative people.
thanks. Your average jackass. Thanks. We're both really smart and creative. Yeah. That's our problem.
Well, that's the case with all psychedelics. I mean, in the scenes that I've run in for 20 years, they've all been like extremely talented, intelligent people, sensitive, conscious people. I mean, you occasionally get the dumbass, but they kind of stick out because they're a dumbass. And, you know, I'm not trying to be mean or anything, but I'm talking about just basic intelligence quotient and not, you know.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Good person or not.
Sure. I mean, yeah. It almost seems like this kind of grandiose psychosis is also an intelligent person problem, because we're always running around trying to put the pieces together and figure stuff out. You know, we can't just have a phenomenal experience and have it be a phenomenal experience and say, oh, that was fun. What's next? You know,
it would be like if a Native American or somebody from a primitive shamanic culture did a massive dose of ketamine or it's the same thing with LSD. When Westerners take it, you know, the whole trope that a Westerner is going to, they're all about the ego, and then the ego gets flat and they freak out and then they turn into Charles Manson or something. I wonder, I would be interested to see how, you know, non-Westerners would take to a strong ketamine dose.
I think Leary tried to do a couple of these studies. Leary and Ram Dass. Ram Dass, I know, took LSD to India and gave it to gurus who meditate. You know, the famous story is Ram Dass gives it to, one of the most famous transcendental meditators ever. And after the session is over, Ram Dass asks him, how was it? And the guru says, I'm not sure I felt anything. Do you have any more?
That might be getting back to your whole ketamine metaprogramming as well.
Right. And so I think the answer to your question is that these substances do have their own particular styles. And I think LSD is very much more intrapersonal and ego driven. And something like mushrooms is very much more involved with these universal archetypes of, creation and death and, the galactic consciousness. And ketamine, of course, is like what did Terence call them? The empty towers?
Yes, empty skyscrapers.
Skyscrapers.
He always liked the whole, you know, ayahuasca and mushrooms because they have thousands of years of ritual that, you know, there's many ancestors back behind us who have done it. And really, James, one day, maybe 1,000 years from now, K-heads will look in their history books and they'll find who knows? They might find us. They won't find a lot of people, though. They'll find John Lilly.
Sure. It all goes back to John Lilly eventually. And yeah. if they dig hard enough, they'll find Marsha Moore. But they had to dig pretty hard to find Marsha Moore after she disappeared.
Yes.
You can go back and listen to the Dark Side of Dose Nation series where I talk about Marsha Moore's disappearance when she was high on ketamine.
You were very kind on that one. I was so mad at her. Now, I got her book, and I went through it, and it's like, the more you know about that, the more you despise. I hate to say that about the dead, but it's just so despicable what she did. And, you know, this whole mindset right now of, oh, we don't like the elites. Well, she was definitely that, and her Armenian husband, and she squandered a lot and lied a lot with the government as well. So
yeah, I didn't go into all of Marsha Moore's past. Like you said, maybe I was trying to be kind to her because I didn't want to focus on, I think I called her like a handful, or maybe she was a difficult person or a self-involved person, and I kind of left it at that. But if you
you're white knighting her.
I don't know if I was white knighting her. She was definitely at the end very crazy. I mean, you can just read her book and see how deep the psychosis goes. And when you read about her latter days, how hard people tried to get her out of her habits, her ritual ketamine habits, and how they ultimately failed. It is a really crazy story. And the fact that she just totally disappeared and they had psychic detectives trying to find her.
Well, I'd like to say, it's because she was believed in astrology and all that superstitious stuff. But then you look at, I look at myself, and I didn't believe any of that, and it was still very alluring, and it was very chaotic in my life for a while. So
yeah, sure.
Science won't save us on that one.
Yeah, I had my own share of crazy, grandiose delusions while I was on it, and had the presence of mind to stop doing it, I guess, at some point.
You were saying in your podcast, and it's a really good explanation. Once you start to believe that you can affect reality with your thoughts, like, there's a lot of New Age talk now where, you know, if enough prayer happens, they can make something happen. And it's very pop psychology, but psychedelic psychosis takes that one step further where you're actually able to kind of real time, like move your hand through somebody. And on ketamine, you may move your hand through somebody, but your hand's really moving in an empty space because you're getting the image of them standing in front of you maybe about a minute later. So, yeah, that's psychosis. That was a really good explanation of it.
Yeah, and I find myself fortunate that I had people around me able to explain to me that what I was saying sounded insane, and also had the presence of mind to make the connection between does my psychosis have anything to do with this ketamine use? And to be honest with you, even though I mentioned that to multiple people in the psychedelic community online or in email, I don't think one person said, oh yeah, chronic ketamine use is associated with psychotic delusions. I don't think one person said that. I don't think that was even in the literature at the time. And it's not just psychotic delusions while you're on ketamine. It could be persistent. If you're taking it chronically, you may have delusions that are persistent all day, the next day, or the next 2 or 3 days.
I'm not so sure if it. If it causes psychosis. I mean, I know you're not saying it causes psychosis, but it gets you into a state where you're all of your little bullshit abstractions kind of become concrete, and you live in your own little world, your little cocoon, and you're controlling reality, but I think it enables people to get more psychotic and neurotic.
Right.
It helps them along, but I'm not so sure it's going to be. It's a slippery slope.
Yeah, it was over a period of months that I began to have what I would call sustained delusions, where I was on a daily basis. On ketamine, I had things like I thought people were stealing my fish. I thought people were following me. I became, paranoid about surveillance and not wanting to say things out loud because the wrong people might hear me.
That sounds neurological. Like maybe you're, I mean, you were shooting up several times a day then.
No. Daily. That was once a day. Once a day, maybe 3 or 4 times a week. Once a day in the evening.
Okay. I mean, yeah. Because of the
one of my rules was that I would never re-up because I wanted to stay away from the repeat use trap. But I decided that if I took 24 hours or a couple of days between uses, that's not repeat use.
Right. Well, and there's also the built-in resistance factor, which I was always butting my head up against. You know, I remember driving and doing a big bump, and I knew that my resistance was so high that I wasn't going to go into a K-hole and crash. I mean, of course, the guy next to me thought I was insane. But, yeah, I mean, it's about like it lasts for a couple of days, the resistance. You build that up. So that's a built-in safety valve I always thought was great with the drug.
Did you ever talk to Carl Janssen for his book?
Yes.
Interview you as like the king of ketamine or something like that?
Well, KB at btinternet.com, I think that was his email. But he came to New York at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine and spoke. And we were also both on BBC talking about the near-death experience. I have it on my site on transcend.org. If you just search for Discovery Channel or BBC, it's in there. He's very hard to understand with his New Zealand accent to me, but it's very fascinating. He had a huge presentation at the cathedral. I love Episcopalians for that reason. But yeah, he was kind of like my hero at that time, you know, him and you actually. So, because I was very focused on getting to the bottom of what ketamine was. And I was a little frustrated that there wasn't more literature and trip reports out there, but it was still relatively new. I mean, it had been invented in the early 60s, I think, 61. So it took another generation. This is what I call the every 30 years cycle. You know, you could go all the way back to the 1840s with the revolutions in Germany, and every 30 years, you know, you got the 30s with FDR and the New Deal and Grapes of Wrath, John Steinbeck, and of course the 60s. And you know, 30 years after the 90s is the 20s. So I think that the 20s are going to be truly amazing.
Well, I hope so. I'm hoping on that.
it might not be as much. I mean, I think the technology is going to determine how that high water mark, as Hunter S. Thompson called, you can see from the hills of the Sierra Nevada, is that high water mark where the waves crash the highest, and technology is going to determine how that happens and how psychedelics are going to fit into the whole thing. But I think that right now with the internet, with microdosing, and basically, you know, you can still order ayahuasca, I believe, Mimosa Hostilis and all that.
Oh, well,
you
can order anything on the dark web. You can take your Christmas card, your Amazon $20 gift certificate that you get from grandma at Christmas, and go on to an online exchange, trade it for Bitcoin, and for that money buy 3 hits of acid that will be in your mailbox next week.
So that explains the big boom in VPNs right now.
No, it is a crazy time. I mean, if people know how to exploit the internet and know how to exploit the dark web.
Yes, I have some friends who are big freaks, and they order from the dark web, but they're very, very paranoid about anything. They use VPNs and Proton Mail and all that.
Sure.
I'm kind of glad in a way that I'm sober these days. I've been sober for a decade, that I don't have to go through that anymore. But at the same time, it was kind of fun to pack a pound of weed in my parachute pants and get them first class on the plane and stink up first class and, you know, smuggle things. It was, it's so old school.
I didn't know that was one of your skills, but okay. So when you first got introduced to psychedelics, was that through Wilson Leary? Were you, this is in Austin, Texas?
I was in Austin. I was writing for the Daily Texan. Mike Godwin, the Godwin's Law guy, he was the editor in chief, and I was the anarchist columnist. And I had taken LSD. It was sold on the drag. They called them drag worms, these old bums, homeless guys. So it's this one guy that I bought from, he didn't have his hand. It was a stump. He was a Vietnam vet. So he held down the sheet of acid with his stump and pulled off pieces for me. That was right around the time that Richard Linklater lived there and filmed Slacker, and a lot of my graffiti was on there. I was a big anarchist.
Hold on, let's back up. You were painting graffiti around Austin that showed up in the background of Slacker?
Yes, yes. It's all over the place, and it was really fun. I lived in a clothing optional hippie commune called the Ark, and
amazing. That's why you're the naked guy.
Yeah, and it was Austin at that time was still a very small town, and it was a great place. I'm sure it's still a great place to take acid because it's got all the hills and it's kind of like northern Italy. But I met Wilson Leary, who was Timothy Leary's nephew. He was just a man about town. He was doing raves and things like that later on. I was there in the late 80s. But eventually I got arrested for selling acid. It was something to do with the Ark.
Something to do with the Ark? What does that mean?
Oh, I was at the Ark, yes. And
I don't know what the Ark is.
The Ark was a clothing optional hippie commune where there was a swimming pool in the middle of a big ring of rooms. It was heaven. But yeah, it was the whole slacker time. Austin was great, but eventually I got arrested. I got busted, and I had to stop. I had to clean up my act, and that's when I got to New York. And I lasted for about 10 years until I went right back into the craziness. Right about that time, that's when, you know, when I moved to New York, I was expecting it to be this big, huge, technological, spotless, like, hip place with good music. And, you know, coming from Houston and Austin, I sold Texas short in the late 80s because Austin and Dallas and Houston, amazing music, clean, a lot of technology. And going to New York, I had to kind of hold my nose for a while because it was just, as you said, the East Coast is all about who you know in this money pyramid, and West Coast is all about experimental living.
Yeah.
And when I went to New York, it was a big, huge letdown. But I was determined to get a whole group of people together, and we were going to like be radical and take LSD and be artistic. And that's eventually exactly what happened. There were thousands of people that I still know. And it's right about that time when I graduated from just LSD to ketamine. I thought it was stupid at first, but after a couple of times, it finally gets those neurons, those receptors in tune. And I had my first intense K-hole at a rave, and I said, this is it. I found it. And that's right about the time I met you.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think around 96, we ran into each other at Burning Man. You had this big resonator. It's like a vibrating bed or something like that.
Yeah, that was in, I think it was the Flesh Lab camp. That was not my installation. That was a friend of mine's installation, but I was actually running it for 3 hours that afternoon when you showed up. So I was giving everybody resonator rides that afternoon, and we popped you on the resonator. And the resonator is, I think it's like 20-inch subwoofers in a huge wooden cabinet the size of a queen size coffin with an inflatable mattress on the top of it, so that when you play, you know, trance music or psychedelic music through the box, it vibrates, and the person on the bed, they wear headphones and listen to the music as the big box goes.
I remember that. And the person, I thought it was kind of perverted.
It vibrates your whole body. Like
a bunch of people sitting on a big, huge vibrator, but it inspired me. I saw the Brain Machines at a rave in Oakland right about that time. And so I said, I'm going to put Brain Machines and put on the same frequency as a vibrating mattress. And that was a slippery slope right there. I immediately went home. I got these Brain Machines on. And I got the vibrating mattress, and I was on neurotropics, and I was on LSD, I was on this oxygen stuff, And then it was all perfect. And then I wet my pants and I realized that I might electrocute myself. So I stopped doing that. I had the electrodes on my ears. It was all on the same frequency. And even the cranial electrical stimulation, it's all synchronized.
Yeah.
But I realized I didn't want to be like a DM Turner. I didn't want to I'm not going to die in a bathtub. At least if I would have died with all that shit hooked up to me, they would have said, "Oh, he was going places."
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's slightly better than autoerotic asphyxiation. It's like, what? He had light machine goggles on his head and a big set of headphones.
That might have saved Michael Hutchins' death, you know.
Yeah, and I definitely went through a period of time where I was experimenting with the mind machines pretty extensively. I used this Proteus mind machine that I got back in probably the late 90s, early 2000s. I also used it a lot with ketamine. And that's kind of where I figured out what the dose range was, where I could still be present and kind of manipulate my brain with the various frequencies that I was playing through the mind machine, and the dose range where your brain just shuts off and shuts everything out. And whatever you're playing in your head doesn't really matter because
it's a benchmark. It's like one of those little TikTok clocks that, you know, you can play music to. It gives you kind of sense. It connects you to time more than anything, which is great. And you can obviously adjust the frequency to where if it's, you know, if you want to be in a certain wakeful state. I mean, I usually run around 8 to 12 hertz, which is beta waves, I believe.
Yeah.
And that's relaxed. But
8 to 12 is like alpha range.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Which is relaxed. Yeah.
BATHD, beta, alpha, theta, delta. Okay.
Yeah, in descending order.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, a lot of, I did a lot of brain machine experimentation, and I tried, and I did it with ketamine because it was really easy to run a routine. I know that ketamine would be, you know, 45 minutes, 50 minutes long, so I could program a 50-minute routine that would run through. So I knew at various times when the routine shifted from this place to that place how far I was along in the trip. And then, like, at the last 10 minutes, it shifts into a very low-frequency theta state. So as I'm coming out of the trip, I'm in a very light trance state. And it just sort of, you know, slides me back into consciousness in a very liminal state. So I did a lot of kind of extreme trip programming with the Proteus and ketamine, which sort of led me to study brainwaves, you know, and try to figure out what each level of brainwave activation did and how it affected consciousness. And of course,
well, you and I were both doing the 90s thing, weren't we? We had the brain machines, the 90s we had the LSD, we had the electronic music, we had the ketamine. I remember in New York, there was a Synchro Energize. That was a big place where people would go with the brain machines. Montreal had something similar. I'm sure the West Coast had all sorts of things as well. It's a lot more decentralized, though.
Eventually, I decided that there was just, you know, and I couldn't do it with LSD. I tried doing it with LSD a couple times. But there were just too many cords and buttons and knobs and input jacks and things that I had to arrange on my head. And on LSD, that all just became too cumbersome. And I was like, screw this toy. But I like, threw it all away.
I can imagine. There's too many details. It's too...
The walls are breathing and everything is coming in around you, and there's this little device that's going, and it's like, get away from me.
Well, I ended up taking, I had an installation of 10. I would take it out to parties. And I would set it up and I'd charge like $5 or something, have quotes of Timothy Leary on an LED sign. And I did that for years until a friend of mine got a seizure from it. And I'm really glad that it was a friend. And she only like broke her nose. I mean, the guy that I got the idea from, who was Dr. Ecstatic's Brain Machines, he did it out in the desert in Northern California. And a girl had a seizure, and her mom was a lawyer.
Ooh.
So he stopped doing his thing. You can still see it on if you Google image. He was my inspiration.
Who was that?
Aaron Kohick.
Oh, okay.
K-O-H-I-C-K. He was based out of San Francisco, I believe, and I first saw it at a Megabuzz One, which is a big rave in Oakland. But that's and I got that idea, and I got the vibration thing from you, and then I just threw in the cranial electrical stimulation. It was great. I had these ideals of, you know, technology. This is back when Timothy Leary was showing up at Limelight with Lord Michael and doing all the virtual reality, and where he's going, wow, I feel like I'm on drugs. And
so
it was really primitive shit back then.
Limelight was a club, the psytrance club.
It was in kind of like Cathedral St. John the Divine. It was an Episcopalian club in Chelsea, and I lived a block and a half from there, so I was there all the time with Michael Alig and all those people. I ran into a lot of different scenes, and that was one of them. It was an amazing time. There was Timothy Leary was kind of milking his whole celebrity and being on the cutting edge, Mr. Mondo 2000 style. And New York was a great time. I mean, I had that installation for probably until about 2001 when I was so delusional that I moved into a vacant building in Tribeca, which is right next to Wall Street. And there was hookers who were shooting up ketamine. I lived in a penthouse and I could overlook all of downtown Manhattan. It was the rent back then was about $6K a month. It'd probably be about $25K now, but eventually the cops came and they found they didn't find anything. But when they came in, they said you have to move out of here. So they saw a Viking helmet. I was part of the techno Viking thing. But one of the cops picked up the Viking helmet, put it on his head, and underneath the Viking helmet there was a jar of ketamine.
Ooh.
And they go, sit down. And so they start digging. They eventually find a tennis racket bag full of Pez that had something on each.
Uh-huh.
And they took me in. And I remember my computer, my laptop, had that voice from Hal that would say, my mind is going. And they thought it was a bomb. It was one of those alarms, low battery alarms. So it was a stressful time. I was facing 25 years under the Rockefeller laws because they count the weight of the actual thing that it's on.
So you were getting charged for the weight of the Pez, not the weight of the substance on the Pez.
Yes. But by miracle, the guy I was living with before I moved in there, this couple, he wouldn't let me keep all the Pez in the refrigerator because he was really paranoid. So I lived in a heated room with this hot air blowing. The hot air, I knew it was affecting the quality of the acid, but When the test came back from the NYPD, they didn't test positive, which was a miracle. I spent my entire 401k on the president of the New York Criminal Bar to be my lawyer. And at the hearing, he said, the judge says, we have charges that this man is running a drug lab in an abandoned building, and there's a lot of drugs there, and there's a lot of criminals there. My lawyer got up and, you know, the judge knew he was the head of the New York Criminal Bar. He said he'd just gotten laid off from The Economist. And somebody said he could move in there, and who knows what was what. That wasn't his place. And he's got an interview in 2 weeks. So the judge put down his gavel and said, we're going to release him on his own recognizance. And the DA just shit their pants. They were so mad. But
had you actually just been laid off from The Economist?
Yes.
And how deep into the New York corporate society scene were
you? I was at Adweek. I was there for years. And then I was at Bloomberg. I was head of all the Texas operations for their advertising. I was a hardcore, you know, yuppie advertising executive. But I saw how empty it all was. I saw how pointless it all was. And I realized how poor everyone really is, unless you're a billionaire.
Right.
Even if you're a millionaire, you know, your income goes up, but in New York, where it's all about the clothes you wear and the places you go and all, I felt like a rat race that I just wanted to opt out of. And I'm not a tune-in, drop-out kind of guy, but even though I did meet Timothy Leary in Austin, but he's always been my hero, and I realized that my passion was this stuff that we were doing, these drugs and this technology, and everything else, I didn't want to, like, I felt like it was amputating a part of my body by getting a job, a normal corporate job. It felt like we've only got a couple decades on this planet, and why do I want to spend any of it doing something I don't want to do that feels pointless? And it's very selfish of me to feel that way. I understand that, but this is my passion. So even though I've been sober for 10 years, it's still something I'm very passionate about. So I've been trying to maintain a community of people that have taken psychedelics, that are very clear-minded, intelligent people. But you don't. My whole credo now is that you don't have to be doing, you know, it's like what Terrence McKenna said. Once you've heard the music, you don't have to keep it on repeat. You can just say, okay, I've heard the music, and move on with your life rather than getting stuck in some sort of cycle of addiction.
I want to go back to this New York scene because you were part of a really active psytrance scene, and probably a couple different scenes in the whole time that you were there. And you were the guy that would show up in the Brooks Brothers suit. Right.
Yes. I was all over the Upper East Side, Harvard Club. I went out with Carmen D'Alessio, who helped start Studio 54. I like to do everything. So I was out every night till like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. But I always liked this rave, this techno shamanism sort of thing that was just sort of sprouting up with Terrence McKenna. So, but I eventually, you know, I was going to Twilo a lot, but then I boycotted them after they didn't let my brain machines in. Sasha and Digweed's manager said, oh, it'll cause seizures. So I said, fuck you, Sasha and Digweed. So I went to the psytrance scene, which I thought was kind of dirty.
Sure.
But I decided out of spite that I was going to go put all my energies into those. And right about that time I met Alex Gray. He was, you know.
Building the chapel.
Know, famous artist. Yeah. No, this is way before. This is in the 90s.
Way before the chapel.
Yeah, and so I eventually got an email list, and we started. I just archived them all on my site. There's 1.5 million lines of text and all those email lists. I mean, that was the thing. We had several lists. Some of them were paid secret. Some of them were built around ayahuasca. I got a mobile sound system. I got a golf ball sized chunk of DMT. I got about 10,000 doses of the psilo acid. And we just went on and on.
Right.
And on.
So let's talk about the psilo acid. You mentioned in one of your recollections, or maybe I can't remember what it was. Maybe you listed all the archetypes of the 90s trance scene. And at some point you mentioned that once the psilo bust happened, the bottom dropped out of the New York trance scene because I guess the music wasn't that interesting to listen to. And without the LSD.
Yeah. It's like the drunk scouts of America, you know, and your Tales from the Trip side when one of them was going, you know, I'm learning to tolerate psytrance for my rave culture badge.
I can't believe you brought up Tales from the Trip side. You can't. that's out of print. You can't find that anymore.
Yeah, I know. It's technically out of print, and it'll stay out of print. So
yeah, that was a sketch comedy DVD that Scott O'More produced in association with Trip Magazine back in the 90s, where we did all sorts of goofy sketches that I got pulled into a few of them. So if anybody is interested in seeing that,
is good with me. I will not, you know, we'll just let it stay dead.
I think Scotto was embarrassed of the production quality now looking back 25 years or so. But I still have a few copies of the DVD. So
Drug Side Story.
Okay. Drug Side Story was good, by the way.
Yeah,
I thought there was some really good sketches. There was a hit. I think it was overall it was a hit or miss thing. There was a couple really good sequences in there, and Drug Side Story was definitely one of the hits.
Well, back to psytrance. You have to be on a lot of acid to really get it. It's like alchemy. It's like any recipe. You have to have. You can hear psytrance sober, and it's, you know, you can get into it. It's the beat goes about the same frequency as your brain when it's in a relaxed state. But it's once the acid ran out, eventually the scene died, and you know nothing lasts forever.
Didn't you become the ayahuasca guy after that?
I went once the acid ran out, we started doing, I started going really small. We'd go out to like the park, we'd go out, we went out to the parks by monasteries, parks along the beach, we'd go camping, and I just ordered it online and just made it. One time I put some detour in it. Well, I'll never do that again. I saw just everything was like melting glue, and I saw horns everywhere, and I understood what the witches went through when they inserted in their vaginas with the broomsticks. It was really freaky.
I think
then
that's
I realized
a myth.
Why Western society is so whacked, because that's the only psychedelics our culture had. And
oh,
we're really part of a process of learning these new chemicals that we got. It's almost like, vodka. Vodka came first, but it took 500 years for ayahuasca to become hip and cool to do. So I was in that for a while, and then eventually somebody I inspired, because I had found a great mixture of paracetam and acetylcholine and homozone, which is basically ozone, and you mix them all together and you get really smart. You get undeniably really smart for about, it feels like about a third IQ boost, memory boost, for about a month and a half.
What's the combination again? Give us the combination. Paracetam. Yeah.
Paracetam, which is really cheap. Acetylcholine, you can get a health food store.
Acetylcholine.
It's really magnesium oxide. It's got, it's nascent O3, and you take that with a lemon, and that releases ozone into your system, which bonds with free radicals in your system, and it flushes up. But you get a surfeit of oxygen in you. Acetylcholine works. I just found that those three worked really well together. Paracetam will do it by itself, but I wasn't expecting anything. It was the most amazing. One of my most amazing discoveries was akin to discovering LSD, taking those smart drugs together. So I made this article
on
my
website. Is this recipe on your site?
I talk about it. My site at that time was brainmachines.com. I've since sold the domain to Mind Machines. But one of the people in my little larger society there read it, started a smart drug company, hired me. I went in there. He was crazy. He died soon of just taking everything. So I went back to Brooklyn, and I had a NootropicaNutrition.com, and that was a smart drug company. We would basically import kilos of white powder from China, and if the FDA stopped it, the crafty Chinese supplier would bribe DHL to get it straight on through. It's a very dicey business. I mean, you're talking, I would say that was felt riskier and more fly of the pants than selling acid. Because acid, you once you take a drop of it, its strength. But China was hard because there was all this stuff in it that might be in there. I mean, they have no quality controls. So I had that in the mid-2000s. Eventually the bottom fell out on that because there wasn't really enough market. And also, cocaine was being sold at the deli across the street, I found, unfortunately. And you go in and order white parliaments or green parliaments, and these little Mexican guys would give you a little matchbook, and that probably contributed to it. It was,
You were taking cocaine on top of your nootropic recipe?
Yes. Well, I did that. I stopped taking. That's not even the end of it. I stopped taking nootropics because you can only really go into the paracetam thing for about a month and a half. But I found out, this is dangerous knowledge, Ayurvedic medicine, the Makuna Purians, replenishes your dopamine. So you can store a line of cocaine, and every line is like the first line, and you never go down. So me and my girlfriend would do cocaine for days, and that's really bad.
So tell me again what it is that restores your dopamine. The Ayurvedic
Makuna Purians. It's an Ayurvedic herb, but
Makuna,
I don't want that to get in the wrong hands. I'm just saying, people don't do drugs. If you're listening to this, that's a perfect example.
But this is isn't that a bit
of knowledge is going to end up fucking you big time, because cocaine has this nice built-in, kind of like ketamine, but it has this nice built-in bad hangover that prevents your back of your mind from doing it ever. But if you can remove that hangover, it's almost like Aladdin's come out of the bottle and he's giving you whatever you want. And that's not a, what ends up happening is you run out of money very quickly.
I see. Because, so this is more of a financial cautionary.
Yeah.
Probably.
But I was thinking about what we were talking about before, which was this whole Messiah complex.
Right.
And, you know, I thought long and hard about this, and I think it's an early adopter process. It's a universal Jungian archetype of you feel like you're carrying the cross. You're the guy who's you're pushing the envelope. You're being very abnormal, and you're going against the norm. You're trying to change things. So you suffer because people go, look at that guy, and you make all the rookie mistakes. And I'm talking about a general Messiah complex, and there's a Jesus archetype that goes on with any field, really. We can get very specifically into psychedelics and the, you know, what Pinchbeck went through in 2012 and what I feel like I went through. And I think what a lot of Westerners go through when they take a lot of psychedelics and they feel like they're being all edgy and really underground and pushing the envelope, which we definitely card carrying have been those people.
Yeah, and I think I actually fell into a little of that for a while, except I never really had myself convinced that I had all the answers. I just felt like I was close. You know, if I just stayed on it long enough, I would.
If you do another line or do another shot,
right?
Or
yeah, or took some time to evaluate what I've been through and then go back at it with a different angle. But so, do you think it's something that just happens early on in the exposure to psychedelics, or are you saying that it's something that only happens with maybe young people who first get exposed to it?
I don't know. Terrence McKenna and Leary have milked that well into old age, but maybe that's just because, like a lot of people, that was their only gig. After a while, they burned all the other bridges. I mean, look at the Messiah complex thing that Leary went through. I mean, hell, he could have like easily been like the cool inner secret guy, who the head of the Harvard psychiatry department, had a lot of weight. He could have had orgies, kind of like that rocket engineer in LA who was really into the occult and knew the guy from Scientology, kind of like that, kind of more kind of like, you know how swingers are politically conservative
sometimes? Yes
they tend to be. James would go, well, I don't know, some of us are pretty liberal.
I think Seattle is a...
He could have led that life,
sure.
But he chose to do the Jesus Messiah thing.
I think Leary probably lived a little bit of that life. You know, I don't think Leary was above swinging or hitting on other people's wives or actually having sex with
them. Oh, sure, he had that too, but he also wanted to open the door real wide and let all the plebs in on his stuff.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That is where he did come into conflict with many other people. In the psychedelic community.
He gave up more than 99% of people do. It would be like Trump taking ayahuasca. You know, it's like, well, okay, I was wrong about it. It would be that much of a dichotomy there. I mean, you know, you're a successful guy. I've been a successful guy. I've probably given up more than you because I'm more wild and carefree than you, I think.
Probably.
But Leary was he was a blue chip Eastern establishment, like, you know, intellectual.
Oh, yeah, West Point grad, test. Harvard grad, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So I would almost put more worth in him than anything anybody else does, including us, because of what he gave up.
So there's, I think I want to pick this apart and go back to this one topic that I wanted to come back to, which was somewhere, I don't know, many years after we had lost contact, I get a message out of the blue from you on Facebook that says, hey, James, just checking in with you, wanted to say what's up. I had to stop doing K because I started feeling like I was an ambassador for the aliens. To humans.
Oh, yes.
And
that I was the one.
Yeah. And I just wanted to step back before you go into that. I wanted you to talk about that a little bit because I have heard that same thing from multiple different people. And I even kind of went through maybe 5 or 10 minutes of that on ketamine one night where I was almost sure that was true.
Was it just ketamine or was it other things?
No,
like
it was just ketamine. But then it wore off and I was like, oh, That's
we may have something there because, you know, I've taken lots of other things.
Well, but yeah, but other people.
There might be something with ketamine, the whole, you know, you're out of your body, you're out of your normal life, and you're on some sort of astral cosmic grid, four-dimensional, eight-dimensional grid. You're able to get so far out of yourself that maybe there's something to do with that process that pushes people towards that they are. Because if you think about it, the only real constant in that whole universe is you and your little silver cord.
Yeah.
And so therefore you get a greater sense of a string theory sort of connection into some galactic intelligences.
Well, I've heard this from people who have taken ayahuasca, who were taking mushrooms, usually also from people who've taken LSD, usually people who are taking it chronically over a period of time. At some point in their psychosis, this becomes part of the narrative that they're maybe not in contact with aliens, but are getting some sort of message that the aliens are coming and that you are going to have to be instrumental in managing that first contact relationship between the aliens and the humans, like being some sort of ambassador or whatever.
Well, I think that aliens is kind of like, it could be a lot of things like gods, and it's just sort of a stand-in, a synecdoche of a lot of other things that they could be implying. Beings of higher power, I think, is the commonality.
But how did yours manifest specifically? And why was that sort of like the breaking point for you?
Well, I was really into astronomy and astrophysics at the time. I still am. And so I just assumed that there was alien life out there. And if you connect the dots, if you look at it logically, I came into my psychosis from a logical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
If an alien civilization has been around for a million years longer than us, then they would be almost beyond gods to us. They would have all sorts of crazy intelligence. They would be everywhere. And rather than us not being interested in the ant, they may be hyper interested. This kind of starts getting at astrophysics and Fermi's paradox and everything like that. But if an alien intelligence was around long enough before us, they would be so advanced that there would be, a galactic sort of in communication going on. And I really did believe that if you just were able to chemically isolate your brain and consciousness from your body and the material world, you would be able to, you know, those radio frequencies. Did you ever get into that trip with ketamine where as you were going in, you heard like a clock ticking, and then that clock ticking became a carrier wave?
Yeah.
And then you kind of, I felt that. I completely glommed onto that. So I kind of put two and two together, and there still might be something to that, you know, when you're on ketamine, you may be more receptive. I know I'm saying something dangerous with like Lily here, but
I would gather that maybe you're less receptive because it's an anesthetic. But we're not trying to cross swords here. I'm just trying to get to the feeling that you had and
that's,
maybe how
that's
long
how I got to that delusion.
And were you telling basically. People? Were you telling people this, or was this just something that you were kind of keeping to yourself?
It's well, like a lot of things with ketamine, you can't really relate it to other people. You can't bring that object, like, you know, DMT, you can't bring it back.
Yeah.
It's really hard to communicate that to somebody. And so I realized how stupid it would sound. And it's, even now when I say it, it sounds incredibly delusional. And it is. I mean, but I came into it from a rational physics, you know, perspective. But now that time has passed, it's been about 20 years. Actually, this is a very small detail, but it kind of matters a lot. We're actually really early on in this universe. We might be the first life, because if you look at the whole age of the universe, I mean, we're only about 5% in. So we might be one of the first. We very well could be one of the first. So I'm not so hyped on this aliens are everywhere thing, especially because I'm sober and not on drugs.
Yeah, you hear how old the universe is at one point in your life, and you think, oh my God, that's astronomically ancient. That's super old. But then when you actually sit back and think about it, you know, and try to count back the years and figure out how many thousands of millions and millions of that. It's, you know, it's surprisingly not that old. I mean, it's not as old and ancient as people would like to claim it is, just because human civilization is very, very young. The universe in comparison seems very old. But when you look at like what's actually out there in the universe, there's not a lot of old stars out there. I mean, it's all very kind of young, blossoming stuff that's going on right now. But so the did that thinking lead you to some sort of spin out, or did that just sort of leave you when you stopped doing ketamine?
Well, I mean, I never really just went around and started telling people that I am the chosen one. It was a feeling and an intuition, and not so subconscious. I really did think about it, but it's, you know, and you have to realize at that time I had the sound system. I had all the email lists. I had all the connections. I was the underground psychedelic guy in New York for a very long period of time. You know, I had the golf ball sized chunk of DMT. I had the 1,000 pits of the psilo acid. And I had the website, and I basically was very, I identified completely with psychedelic trance and culture. So to add on top of that, that I was sent by the aliens would have been too much for people to take. You know? I mean, people already thought I was kind of an egomaniac, crazy guy, and I didn't need to add fuel to that fire. But I certainly felt some sort of unspoken alien inspiration. You know, I mean, I didn't get too far with that because I realized, you know, once I sobered up, and I was sober a lot too, I wasn't just doing ketamine all the time. I did it every day practically, but I was kept on hitting the resistance part. And during that time, you were kind of forced to be normal for a while. And that's incidentally why a lot of people turn to alcohol after the K period.
You said that you had your brain scanned to see what the chronic ketamine use had done. Was that specifically to examine?
Well, it wasn't specifically that. It was something to do, and I don't know the specifics. It was at NYU as a study in like the early 2000s. A couple of friends and I who had done a lot of ketamine knew some girl who worked in the lab there, and they were looking for people who had done a lot of ketamine to test a certain similar neurotransmitter action with schizophrenia.
Yeah, I remember these studies.
The doctor who I scored some weed for, I thought that was kind of funny. You know, when they were searching my backpack when I went into the hospital about to go into the PE scan, they were going through my backpack, and I said, oh, I forgot I left a needle in there.
Oops.
And so I had to warn her, and she was very polite. She says, oh, okay, thanks for telling me.
Were they scanning you on ketamine, or?
No, just they actually gave the me effects a little bit of speed.
Oh.
Right before, somehow to prime my brain for, you know,
this sounds good.
The process.
Do you think the alien thing, I mean, when were you going through that? Like 99, 2000?
Yes.
Was that, were you a big X-Files fan? Did you watch a lot of X-Files?
Of course.
Yeah. So you know, I have
Contact, and I wasn't a Trekkie, but I was really into the best. I mean, I've gone back and collected everything. I hit all the right places. I didn't do Men in Black or Independence Day or any of that crap, but just the really, I mean, I didn't like the later Star Wars. I just liked the first two or three, Cosmos by Carl Sagan, you know, that's everything I was glomming onto. And the whole, what had really inspired me initially was reading about techno-shamanism and the whole McKenna thing in the early 90s. I felt that there was going to be an interesting fusion of the whole psychedelics with technology. I thought that that was really, by today, 2020, it was going to be, well, it's actually kind of, it actually all came true. I was about to say they were going to be testing, you know, psychedelics in the lab and doing all sorts of crazy stuff, which they kind of are now, which is
slowly. They're not doing all sorts of crazy stuff, but they're slowly getting there.
Which is the appropriate pace for it.
I guess so. We can do all of the crazy stuff in the amateur community and like blog about it or write up trip reports for Arrowhead. Does anyone do that anymore?
To be designated travelers, and I was going to be one of them.
A designated traveler?
Well, like you know, you would get this John Lilly kind of contraption, and you know, you would be people. You would be like a NASA astronaut. And it's funny, I had a friend over who was a special effects guy. He did the voices for the rat in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I gave him his first ketamine. But he said when he was a kid, he actually, one of his friends was one of John Lilly's kids, and he saw the whole contraption in their garage. It was like in Palo Alto or the Bay Area, something like that. And I thought that was an interesting connection.
What was the contraption, the isolation pack?
The whole sensory deprivation tank, but he said it had all these wires on the outside, and like it was like an antenna or something. He said it looked like a weird like Doctor Who TARDIS travel thing.
So he built like an antenna coil around it.
Yeah, it was just the
maybe he's trying to build a
fast thing to see in your friend's dad's garage.
Yeah, that's the Faraday cage my dad is building around his sensory deprivation tank.
Yeah.
Okay.
Was it a Faraday cage?
It's a cage that blocks it blocks electromagnetic fields.
Mm-hmm.
It basically, it's designed to block electromagnetic field interference from getting into.
Really did that then?
Well, possibly. I mean, if it's got all sorts of wires around it in like a coil or some kind of mesh, then that's probably what he was trying to do.
I mean, I could see you're creating like as near a vacuum sort of environment, vacuum from electromagnetic wave.
But maybe he was trying to amplify. Maybe he was creating like a solenoid that actually created an electromagnetic field inside the tank. Who knows? Because that's what you would do if you wrapped a coil around the tank, then you would actually get an electromagnetic field isolated within the tank.
We might be giving him too much credit, but maybe not. I mean,
maybe he just was like taping wires and antennas to the side of it because he was high.
I spent years thinking he was an heir to the Eli Lilly fortune, and that's basically where all of the drug money was going to him, and he was going off on this weird direction. But then I looked, and I think his dad was just some railroad or construction guy in Minnesota.
Yeah,
so.
He's not associated with the Lilly Pharmaceutical Company at all. I don't think
he does have academic credentials, solid, you know, on almost on a Leary level. But yeah, he was more.
Another strange coincidence was that one of my favorite history facts in the psychedelic community was that Lilly got the money for his dolphin language research from NASA under the auspices that if he could crack dolphin language, he would be able to study and crack alien language should we ever come in contact with an alien species.
Which is kind of wacky, and I'm a pretty fucking wacky person.
That sounds like a really wacky sort of back.
He probably didn't start with that. He probably started with the fact, didn't they give ketamine to astronauts to simulate a weightless sort of environment? I've heard rumors to that. I'm not sure if it's true.
This is where David Bowie's Major Tom song comes from.
Oh, so yeah.
No, I'm kidding, but that sounds that sounds right. It sounds like Major Tom was floating in his tin can high on ketamine.
Lilly probably came into NASA probably on that wavelength. Like they were just really trying to cover every base. And so he came in, and it was an experiment of an experiment, and then he came in and got some funding.
Yeah, I haven't really looked too far into that whole deal. I've just seen it mentioned multiple times in various different articles.
That's Marsha Mason, isn't that her name? That's like her level of chicanery. Like, much props to
Marsha Moore, yes. Yeah, the yogi.
Much props to them for being able to scam the U.S. government to do K. I mean, the rest of us have to, you know.
Was she doing government-funded studies? Was she doing government-funded studies?
She got government funding. That's my understanding. And she kind of she had a grant, or she scammed to get a grant, and she squandered it with it was the NIH or something like that. But it's still amazing. Both she and Lilly both were wheeler dealers when it came to getting their ketamine running. Meaning, it's not that hard to get. I mean, but they were able to successfully grift their way through it, which is kind of crazy. I guess, you know, and I asked you all the questions I was going to ask. I was going to bring up Jordan Peterson and Daniel Pinchback when Jordan Peterson was getting cornered by that pulse. Everything is a spiral. They knew about DNA back in the Stone Age. And he brought up Daniel Pinchback's book as a, but I didn't want to make it all about Daniel. So I left
that. Jordan Peterson used Daniel Pinchback as a reference for how Stone Age people knew about DNA.
Yes, and somebody questioned him on that, and then he started backtracking. And the adventure goes, you just need to really get into this and study it for about 6 months. And by the way, you should read The Cosmic Serpent, but also most importantly, Breaking Open the Head by Daniel Pinchback.
Jeremy Narby. He talks
extensively about the spirals and how, you know, the ancient people were able to, they have spirals in their art because of the DNA spiral.
Yeah.
They just knew, and which is the biggest load of horse shit I've ever heard. But,
yeah.
Right. But then Jordan Peterson was like, we'll see, you know, Crick, Francis Crick, or the two guys who discovered it, he only discovered it on LSD.
Right.
So, an ancient people did, like, ergot and all this psychedelics. So there's a connection.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. That's a little psychotic sidebar for you.
Yeah, so yeah, we basically need more rational people. And then, you know what? I think that that's the general, what you're talking about, the third wave.
Yeah.
That's actually kind of like, it's mainstream now in the psychedelic community to be kind of skeptic. Yes, there are freaks, but the internet has made it possible. It's one of the silver linings of, the whole, there's not like, there's, Daniel Pinchback is not even close to what Timothy Leary was in the 60s. Not even close to Terence McKenna. The psychedelic scene doesn't have a leader, and I think that's great. I think it's a bunch of skeptical people that, if we had a leader that was running around like Charles Manson right now, that would fuck up Matt so bad.
Back in the New York scene, you knew Daniel Pinchback a fair bit. Do you
oh yeah, well, okay, when I was in that squat place down in Tribeca, this fire twirler chick who named Charity had gone down to the Ethnobotanical Conference, which, you know, they had them several years in a row back in the late 90s, but down in Palenque, Mexico, and she was hanging out with all these old crusty guys who just did coke and ketamine and slept with each other's wives and
the seven course, you're talking about the 70s crew.
Yes, those guys. Even even Albert Hoffman,
because they don't have brain machines. They don't have brain machines and psytrance music. They just sleep with each other's wives.
Yes, and then do as much white powder as they can. I remember a friend of mine was down there running around with Albert Hoffman, and Albert Hoffman at one point said, "This is when he was still alive." He said, "They're doing cocaine. Should I do cocaine?" Blank. Blank's my friend's name that I will not mention. And my friend said, no, you're 100 years old or something like that. I don't think you should be starting a new drug. Anyway, so down in Palenque, all that shit was going down. Eventually, Charity brought back, she had met Daniel Pinchback, and this is in 2001, in the summer. And we got to know each other, and he was trying to cure me of my ketamine addiction. Because he was in that big, huge, scary-looking squat with graffiti everywhere, and it was all these rooms. And
is this like the Fight Club house? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, mixed with that place in Oakland that burned down, where all those hippie artists were living, that kind of thing.
Right.
And Daniel, I had gotten this little head tingler thing from Amsterdam that looks like this big, huge rake that fits on your head. It's round and it kind of tingles your head. Right. He was going around my place with that, trying, like a shaman, trying to whisk away the spirits. And then he said, "Jeff," and, you know, I'll give you my first name. He said, "Jeff, you know, when you do ketamine, your soul will never find your body for 20, 30 years after you die. And it may take 1,000 years. You won't ascend to the next plane of existence when you die." And I remember at the time, and I had a needle practically in my arm, and I was like, "Oh, that kind of makes sense." And then when I came down later, I go, "Oh my God." Yeah, I love Daniel, but he's a friend of mine, but I don't agree with anything that he says, unfortunately.
You're planning on continuing archiving at transam.org? That's TRANCEAM.org.
Org. I should be interviewing John Draper soon. He's making me buy his book. He's the Cap'n Crunch phone freak guy.
Oh, right.
He's also a major trans head. So I'm going to like get stories out of him about running into Robin Williams in San Francisco. And I'm going to drill him for information about Steve Jobs and Wozniak. And the man's a very interesting guy. You know, he stayed at my house. I met him on a raid beach in Galveston, Texas. So I'm taking it one interview at a time, one article at a time. But the original Brain Machine site was up for about 15 years, and it went dormant when I had my crisis in the late 2000s. But I brought it back. I've archived a lot of stuff, but I hope to be adding a lot of new current things. This is going to be ongoing. So I appreciate you letting me, having me on your podcast so we can talk about it. Cause, I really, really loved your last 10.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I've promoted a lot of my friends who are skeptics, really love it. And I think that there's a big hole in the psychedelic scene of, rational skeptics. You don't have to be atheist and hardcore Christopher Hitchens, but still, somebody's willing to say no to all the pseudoscience, all the superstitious shit, keeping religion out of drugs. Yeah, sure, they can go together, but I'd rather be more Episcopalian about it than a Southern Baptist.
That's very enlightened of you.
Yeah, just everything in moderation. That's my age talking.
Well, yeah.
But I'm just glad that we both survived all the things that we've gone through and we're able to talk about this today. So, yeah, we were kind of an orphan generation, but it's good to talk to another Gen Xer. And
But we had Usenet and email lists, and we can't forget that.
Email. I'm back to email, and I love it.
Yeah. All right.
Take care, James.
Long live email.
Keep on keeping on.
All right. Take care, man.